What's up, everybody? This is Chef Marcus Samuelson and Jason Diakite, and we are This Moment. And thank you for always tuning in to This Moment, the transatlantic bridge between Stockholm, Sweden, and Harlem. And this one is special, guys. This is our first live show here in New York City, and we want to always bring you the best, most authentic, most incredible conversations. So we went out to no other than DJ Stretch Armstrong. What DJ Stretch Armstrong and Bobito meant to the hip-hop scene in the 90s, you know, it's kind of hard to explain because they really opened it up, right? Everybody that was anybody in hip-hop came to their radio show to get their album, their song released there first, whether it was Nas, Biggie, Tupac, Jay-Z, you name it, Wu-Tang, they all came through. So we want to talk to DJ Stretch Armstrong about hip-hop in the golden era, how to go alternative, and how to evolve within music and how the scene has evolved. This is This Moment. Check it out.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Without further ado, give a big hand to DJ Stretch Armstrong.
Yes. Nice.
Good evening.
Stretch.
Yo.
It's good to have you on, man.
I want to know right away, out from the gate, because you have such a beautiful name, right? Adrian Bartos is incredible. Like, that's a statement by itself. That's your real name?
Yeah.
So where is Stretch and who's Armstrong?
Yeah. I feel like, so Adrian Armstrong, like, no. The whole thing is just fake. When I got on the radio in 1990, I was already playing in clubs, but yeah, what's up? Like, I need a name. And there's a tradition of hip-hop DJs taking on the names of superheroes and comic book characters.
Yeah, so Clark Kent.
If you're tall and you walk through a black neighborhood in New York or probably anywhere in America, they're going to call, some dude's going to, some old-timer's going to call you Stretch.
Yes,
so people did call me Stretch.
Slim could have also
or Slim, yeah.
Slim.
Yeah. So, that's the name. Adrian Bartos. I mean, that's not going to work for doing a hip-hop show in 1990. Like,
I love it.
Might work now.
Now.
2021,
yeah,
it would work perfectly.
That'd be great, but it's too late.
No, it's not.
But thank you for... No one's ever told me you have a really beautiful name.
It's stunning. I mean, I'm like, whoa.
It stunning.
It's like a movie star name.
Yeah.
He's blushing. He's blushing.
But the other cool thing is I love all of those old picture going back, because it's basically Jason's and my life but in reverse, right? So in all the pictures I have from growing up, I'm the only black kid. And most of Jason's pictures, he's the only black kid.
Right.
And your pictures are the reverse, because you're in it and you're feeling it and all the kids love you, and he all of a sudden is this tall dude just like slamming the boards and everything, and you're in it. So we lived the same experience in two different countries. Yours probably much cooler than ours, but still kind of like the odd one out, right? Or not?
Yeah, I mean, by the time I was like doing it, like being in clubs and doing all that, like I'd been so kind of socially acclimated to believing that the world either was or should be multicultural. And that's because of how I was raised. That's the school I went to. That's who my parents were. I mean, my mom was a white Eastern European woman. And, you know, Eastern Europe in the mid-20th century is a, you know, it's a weird place. It's your, it's behind the Iron Curtain.
Russia,
it's not multicultural at all. And then she...
I don't think it is to this day.
No. Really, I mean, it's I mean,
more, absolutely.
I mean, like, Poland has, like, a hip-hop scene and you know, I don't know what the Polish immigration situation is, but, you know, my mom was basically brought to New York by my father. They got married like 6 weeks after meeting each other. They didn't really speak the same language. I mean, it's a crazy story. Yeah. And they,
beautiful.
And they stayed married for 40 years.
Yes.
But she
your
was.
Dad's American.
What's that?
Your dad
my dad's a New Yorker. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I went to a school called Manhattan Country School, which still exists. It's one of the. It's a school that educators from all over the country still look to for ideas, for inspiration on how to be socially progressive. They've got a sliding scale tuition, so if they accept you, they find a way for the finances to work. It's a private school, but
84th off Columbus, right?
Yeah. What's that?
84th off Columbus.
Yeah, they moved there. They used to be on the east side on East 96th Street, and I lived across the street from there as a kid, and my dad taught at the school.
Oh, shit.
So... It was a school, but it felt like an extension of my family. And one of the tenets of the school was that there is to be no minorities in terms of the makeup of the classes. So I was white, but it wasn't like 80% white and 20% Latino and black. It was nice. You know, there were white kids, black kids, Latino kids, some Filipino and Asian kids, but. And that was the first 8 years of my life. And
can we get that back? Is there a way to get that back?
You got
to
go. Amazing. You got to go there.
Yeah.
But you know, it's you know, within that, you know, I knew that like I lived on 96th Street, and uptown from 96th Street was the hood. And
Mario.
And some of my friends were from there, but like I didn't really want to go there because I knew like. I was like a soft white boy from the edge of the Upper East Side, but you know, my father kind of insisted that I go to neighborhoods that I might be afraid of going to hang out with my friends, and like literally he would take me to Harlem and like drop me off at my friend's house, like ring the bell, you know,
you
the parents would come to the
own.
Door, you're like bye, and like and I was like there for the weekend. Like sometimes it was like I'd end up in like. Going to church on a Sunday, like, and like I was never did not grow up religious.
Yeah.
Kind of weirded me out being in church. Oh my god, like Baptist church on a Sunday, or like
dug the music though.
But it was just, and that was, you know, but those are the things that kind of made me not have any inhibition in terms of. Going after what I wanted when I was like 17, 18, 19, like, oh, I want to be a DJ. I want to, and you know, that meant going to record stores and like in Flatbush and traveling to different neighborhoods to get records and to meet, you know, aspiring producers and whatnot. And, you know, in hindsight, I was like, wow, maybe I was a little bit crazy, but it wasn't. It was just how I was socially conditioned. And also, like, to your point about looking at photographs of you, like, being, like, the only person of color in, like, this sea of white people, like, you might, you know, as a black person, you probably grew up in, I'm not sure did you move to Sweden or you were born in Sweden?
I was adopted very early, when I was 3 years old.
So it's your whole life. Yeah, so you grew up in that. Whereas for me, like, I'm as a white guy in New York City, like, it's a multicultural city, but I also am part of, like, the quote-unquote dominant culture, right? So that gives you the luxury to, like, to kind of go into other cultures as you want, like, a la carte. Whereas if you're black in New York, you have your black community, but you're also within a larger culture that is white.
Thank you for acknowledging.
And you don't have the choice. Whereas, like, I had the privilege of having it or not having it. Right? It's a little bit different. And I remember, like, I thought about being in these spaces where I was the only white guy, and like, but all you see for me, all I saw was black. Like, there were no mirrors around. Be like, oh, look at me, white guy. I was like, this is, and it's. kind of cool to have that experience. Like, and you know, for a time being, when I was like maybe like one of like five white people, you know, in a space
in hip hop,
yeah,
in New York hip hop in total.
You know, it was that was a privilege as well. And then as things changed over time, you know, I was the guy to be like, ah, too many white dudes here. No, also knowing like eventually that
enjoying that, the exclusiveness of being the only one.
That my radio show was this invitation to a lot of people, a lot of white people, a lot of young white people. It was an invitation because it wasn't an explicit invitation. It was an implied invitation because by me being who I was, a lot of people saw it and be like, oh, you know what? You can be in this. And I think that's one of the kind of legacies of our radio show. And, you know, for better or for worse, whatever.
Stretch, I just, you know, for me, it's really big just sitting here speaking with you. Just hearing your voice, like, amplified through a mic live in the room is something. It's impossible to kind of overstate the impact that the Stretch Armstrong show had, you know, yours and Bobito's show, on just us, even all the way over in Sweden, you know. When I saw your documentary that came out 2015, A Radio That Changed Lives.
Yes, Stretch and Bobito, Radio That Changed Lives, directed by Bobito Garcia. Gotta give my brother all the props.
And it's
he was invited, but he can't be here tonight.
He's here in spirit.
He's here in spirit. We rep each other.
But
yeah,
when I saw that, I literally cried. And
me too.
I called some of my friends, and I was just like, guys, we have to. I just saw the Stretch and Bobito documentary. We have to all get together and see it. And everybody was like, yes, when can we? And, you know, a few days later, we all saw it again. And it was, I mean, because the title, Radio That Changed Lives, is so true. You know, what you guys
the
did there.
The longest title for a movie.
No, but it you know, you guys started in 1990, 31 years ago. Up at Columbia, so small local radio station, but it literally emanated and went across the globe. I would bring tapes back when I had been visiting my family in New York. I was up every Thursday night, and it was between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. on Thursday.
So, the good hour. Like so the good hour.
Yeah.
Convenient, so, like, convenient. You knew that Friday you were going to be really tired, but you also knew that you had to be awake for the whole show because at any moment, Stretch could drop a new record that you'd never heard before, and that was your way to access new music.
You were one of those guys, like, there's, like, British guys, Swedish guys, some Dutch, some Danish, Japanese,
probably a
little bit of French. These guys from all the world are like obsessed with hip hop. They'd come to New York and just marinate in it for like 2 weeks. They'd go sneaker shopping. They'd go buy the starter hats, 100%. The jackets, tape all the radio shows, buy the mixtapes on Canal Street. Yeah, and then go back with like everything.
And that's how we're super spreaders. Yeah. You know, that's how we spread hip hop culture. Yeah, but I take
soon, man.
But I bring cassette tapes with me back and copy, you know, make 30 copies for my friends, and that's how they'd hear of, like.
But we take different things from this, right? The way what you chooses as your profession. So you studied, I studied just from a fan point of view, right? But I take so many different things from this because, first of all, hip hop today is global, right? Jason brought basically hip hop to Sweden, him and a couple of other people, and made it local, like not just hip hop from America, hip hop in Sweden, and then Jason added his accent. So now it was okay for Swedish rapper to go, not just in Swedish, no, are you Southern? Are you local, right? But what that has in common for me is two things. Like, A, whatever you're passionate about, go for it. It's not going to be easy. You're not going to get the best hour. But regardless, if you do it really, really well, it's going to be this thing that flips everything, right? Because when your show race essentially becomes the gatekeepers of hip-hop, what we know today as Wu-Tang, we see Wu-Tang in the movie, and it's amazing, right? They came, they had to drop their album and come to the studio to see you guys. Before Jay-Z is Jay-Z billionaire today, he had to come and see you. Method Man had to come and see you. I mean, the list goes on. You can tell the list, and you can tell the list 1,000 times better than me. Nas, everything, right? They all had to come. These are icons for us today, but also not all the other icons in America and New York. They're also icons in Ethiopia, in hip-hop in Japan, in hip-hop in northern Sweden. So that thing that you and Bob did really has transcended pop culture forever. And that's fucking incredible. Do you know what I mean? What?
Like, at what point did you and Bobito realize that what you were doing up at, you know, at Columbia was like going worldwide?
I don't think we really understood the full the reality until social media came about, really.
So quite recently then, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we knew that like our tapes were being sold. You know, we were in Tokyo once, and I've been to Japan 29 times. Bob a little less, but like we were there together one time in the 90s, and we went to Manhattan Records, and like there's a whole wall. Yes. Stretching Bobito
tapes. Legit bootlegs.
Well, they were all Tape Kings, which is a company here in New York. Yeah, so funny. So we got back to New York, and then Tape Kings were bootlegging mixtapes, but they were also trying to be a legitimate label. So dude from Tape Kings came to our show one time with an artist that he was putting out, and I'm DJing, so I can't really talk to anybody. Yeah. But Bob pulled the dude aside. He's like, look, I know you came up here, it's, you know, 2 a.m. and you traveled, but you're not really not welcome here until you do the right thing. You owe me and Stretch
a
lot of money for...
We saw the tapes.
So he handled that, and he gave us a check, but it was like based on what? Like just an imaginary number. Like,
Don't ask any more questions.
But the typical... places we knew that we were popping, and like, you know, in the UK, in France, in Northern Europe, and in Japan. But after our movie came out and social media, like people were like jumping out of the cake, like, yo, we're in Bolivia, yo, we're in Romania, I was in China. I was like, we were like, what? Like, we had no idea.
Wow.
And you know, amazing.
But there's something to say. I mean, I was just listening to it before I came down here, but the freestyle of Biggie Smalls, like the first time basically anyone in the world outside of his neighborhood, I guess, or outside of the city ever heard him was on your radio show. And this is an artist that then went on to be, I would say, the first like bona fide superstar rapper, you know, in tandem with Tupac, I guess. But the first to sell more than 10 million records.
Yeah, I mean, he was certainly the...
And
the first crossover artist. From, I mean, like, you could argue that, you know,
and the King of New York,
Run-DMC was in the 80s. First, but
how did that come about? Like, how did you guys manage to get him on the show and even have, like, this guy should
come. The industry back then was small. And, you know, there were a handful of labels. And, of course, major labels were trying to get in the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had been, you know, since the dawn of hip hop. I mean, you know, Mercury Records put out Curtis Blow. So major labels have always been trying to exploit the culture. But in terms of labels where there were real people that were from the culture trying to advocate for, like, you know, real artists, there weren't that many people, and there weren't that many journalistic outlets, and of course the Source magazine was one of them.
Yeah.
And we had like this, you know, synergistic relationship with the Source. So Bobito wrote for the Source in addition to working at Def Jam as a promotions guy, and I guess he was being brought in to do A&R, although I don't think that anything that he ever brought in was ever signed. So we knew the guys at the Source. Of course, I said, Bob had the first sneaker column ever in the Source, and there was a column called Unsigned Hype, which Maddie C. Mm-hmm. wrote, and Maddie was the dude that discovered Biggie through a tape that I believe was submitted to Unsigned Hype, and he brought the tape to Puffy.
Yeah.
And through the neighborhood, Biggie and Mr. C, who was Big Daddy Kane's DJ, they had already sort of, struck up a relationship. But Maddie was like the guy that started making it happen. And whenever anyone that was kind of like one of those kind of conduits to make things happen discovers an unknown talent, you just try to like make things happen for them, because it wasn't always about, oh, like I'm gonna find this guy and make a lot of money. It was like, a lot of us were really young and just wanted to help guys out.
Yeah, love the game.
Because this guy was the shit. So,
I guess kind of instantly recognizable.
Right. So Maddie brought him to Puffy because he knew Puffy was starting his own label. Mm-hmm. He was leaving Andre Harrell at Uptown to start Bad Boy.
Yeah.
But he also had them come up to the show. And we already knew Mr. C. Like, Mr. C was already a legend as Kane's DJ. But that's how Biggie ended up there. Because if Maddie was like, yo, I got someone needs to come up, like, we knew that was going to be Flavors. So Biggie came up, and it was actually the week after we played Biggie's demo on the radio. Now, Bob had this idea to have demo battles on the radio where he'd play two songs.
Nice.
And
that's a good idea.
It's really not a good idea. It's not. And you'll see why. So Bob was like, oh, we're going to play Biggie Smalls demo, and then we're going to play some cats from the Bronx called the Bronx Zoo.
Yeah.
And we're going
to
see
who's
going to win. And I think like the Bronx Zoo guys just had... they may have known what was going on because maybe one of their boys had heard it. Maybe Biggie's boys were just like out on the block like hustling or whatever. But, Bob did a very unscientific survey, like among like 10 calls. Like, call us to you. Like, yeah, 10 people called up and like 7 voted for the Bronx Zoo. Because maybe like those 7 people were from the Bronx.
I'm from the Bronx.
It's got to be the Bronx Zoo.
718 Bronx.
Yeah. So Biggie lost. Oh. So when he came up the next week, he was really salty and had something to prove. And he says it.
Yes.
If you leave, he's like, yo, I got something for those Bronx Zoo cats.
Yeah.
Okay.
And another friend of mine who was doing promotions for Arista, because Bad Boy had a deal through Arista, he was like, yo, I was on this bus we rented to do a radio tour up and down to bring Biggie like to college and community and commercial mix shows. Mix shows are like that in the early to mid 90s, there was really no such thing as hearing hip hop live on the radio in the daytime like you do now. It was Friday nights and Saturday nights, or Thursday nights in our case, where a DJ would play rap music, because in the daytime
it wasn't loud.
That was like, what? Rap on the radio? Like, no. I mean, we live in a very different world right now. And so my man was like, yo, Biggie was so salty that he lost. Like, he was legit angry, and that's why you and Bob are not thanked in the long list of thank yous.
It was a bad idea. I take it back. It was a bad idea.
I was like, oh, like you read thank you.
Because a couple
like,
of years had gone from that until the album comes, right?
Two years
or something.
It was like, bitter.com.
But I mean, at least nobody rolled up to the studio with
that was Wu-Tang. Yeah. They did that.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the big, because there's so many bigots, and it's really hard to put this in context, but like, I want to know, when was the moment for yourself where, like, you were just blown away, like when a young Nas comes in or a young Jay-Z or
Big L,
someone that we actually don't know, that was like, this blew you away.
Yeah, I mean, people always ask us like, what were your favorite moments, and like most of them are highlighted in our documentary. you know, if I had to redo the film, like, I'd probably include Mobb Deep a little bit more.
Oh, wow, yes.
Just because they're, I think they're like indelibly associated with our show. I mean,
yeah.
They first came up as Poetical Prophets. They weren't even Mobb Deep yet, and they were kids. I mean, there's a slide in our documentary. It says Mobb Deep, but they weren't even Mobb Deep then, and they must be like 13 and 14 years old. I mean, they're babies, killing it, but still babies.
Yeah,
and I mean, I tried to sign them back then to Big Beat Records, which was the independent label that Craig Kalman, who's now the chairman of Atlantic, had. I worked for him as a 19-year-old, so I went way back with them, and like, so there's like a Mobb Deep thread through my 90s career, and like as they kind of splashed harder and harder, so did we. There's a parallel there, and they would kill the station when they would come up.
Wow.
And they always bigged us up whenever they did interviews and whatnot. So that's not one moment, but that's one a group. And I mean, really, I think the highlight for us was like the second time Nas came, because the first time he came was in 1991, and Bob wasn't even at the station.
I didn't know that.
He came up with Akineli and Lord Finesse and ripped it. And then the second time he came up was like, you know, we already knew like who he was and what this meant. Mm. So it was like a big deal for him to come up. But when he first came up, like he had already had that verse on Live at the Barbecue. And the fact that Bob couldn't be there was like a big deal for Bob. He was like, I cannot believe I'm not going to be there for this. Cause I mean, can you imagine hearing an artist you never heard of just one verse and knowing that he was like Rakim 2.0,
that's the waving automatic guns at nuns, right?
Yeah. You know, there was a, you know, this is pre-digital, pre-like explosion of information. So everything was a lot more measured and slow, and every kind of taking in of a song or whatever, like it was a bigger deal, and it lasted longer. So like that verse that Nas did on Live at the Barbecue was huge. It was a big deal, this unsigned dude, like, he'd come up and like we'd be like, yo, Nas is coming. Like, we'd be little,
and he's like 18, 19 at the time, maybe.
I don't know,
he's young.
In 91 he probably was like 17 and then he revealed to us in the documentary that he wrote a lot of Illmatic listening to our radio show. That really was like, what?
So I have to bring that back, because at the same time, and again, Jason is now making big decisions, because you now, like, you're working already in the industry. You're trying to figure out what's based. Like, what's happening with you at that
not
point?
At that point.
Come on,
no,
tell me what's going on.
But at that
Sweden,
point,
96, I know, 95.
Oh, 95, but 91, I'm still in school. But the thing is, what you're saying is also so true, because in the pre-digital world, and especially being in one of the corners of the world, like, we'd hear maybe through a 3-month-old copy of The Source that had arrived at a local news vendor that, you know, I saw the unsigned hype with Biggie, but I still hadn't, you know, heard it. But we would hear of it. I don't know how, you know, there'd be some DJ maybe in Copenhagen who knew of something or who had something, and a tape would, you know, circulate. But just from hearing about that, a new, like when Nas dropped Halftime, that hearing that that song was out and waiting maybe 4 months to actually get to hear it was crazy.
There is a song like in New York.
No, but we'd literally be willing to go to another country, like to Denmark, to try and find it. Not even having the money to be able to buy it, but to just listen to it in the record store. So, like, searching for music and information about this culture that we were so drawn to was like a full-time endeavor.
These are the rituals that kind of like inform the whole experience. And I think, I mean, taping the radio was what anyone that was into this did for years. I mean, until the internet, that's, you yeah. did that. Yeah. And
yeah.
And I think you know, I think we've the advent of like digital technology and the internet has changed so much. And one of the things I think we explore in our film is, you know, what we gave up for it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's great to be able to have like random access to any song in the world and to be able to, oh, yo, Marcus, look, check this song and yeah. send it to you. But I think the lack of ritual True. has kind of cheapened
yeah,
everything.
It makes everything much more like ephemeral or temporary.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
it's
But how, I also want to ask you.
Expendable.
Yeah, I mean, I remember buying, you know, when I was on one of these kind of pilgrimages to New York where I had, you know, saved up but still a limited amount of money. I made what I realized when I came back was a wrong decision. I bought a Canine Posse album and I came home and I was like, this is not great, you know, but it is a hip hop record. I listened to that album until like I knew the lyrics and liked it, you know.
And at what point did you realize it was no good?
Well, what's going on? From the first listen, but I listened to it until it worked, you know. I just like, there was no, you know.
Guys, the Canine Posse, your friends were like, no, what's going on?
Yo, oh, they had never heard. There's like, we haven't heard of them. Yeah. You know, we know who KMD is, but not this other record that you got.
That was a mistake. We appreciate your
honesty. But it was just like, I, you know, you'd live with a record for a long time. You wouldn't like, you're, you know, in this age of algorithms where companies and computer software measuring the skip rates on tracks to get us to be even more efficient, or on Netflix about how culture is produced, you know. I mean, even though I didn't like the Canine Posse album, my skip rate was really low because I was like listening to it until this is one of the 9 records that I own. I'm gonna listen to this shit, you know.
So I want to. One of the things that I always admire about you is that, first of all, you're in a New Yorker and you live a full life. We both love the game of tennis. We're living in New York, but okay.
This looks like a formidable.
Oh no!
Come on, the funny thing is, my first interaction with you ever was at that Swedish ping pong thing.
Okay, yeah.
And yo, Marcus, first of all,
he's fast.
It was doubles. He destroyed my team. I was like, yo, Marcus is nasty. And then we both ended up in Jamaica together.
Yeah,
and
he takes
no
prisoners.
Let's play tennis. I was a little bit nervous.
No, we played.
I'm better at tennis than ping pong.
Yeah.
But you were a lot friendlier one-on-one in Jamaica than at that that ping pong match, because he was cold-blooded. My man was cold. I was like, yo, this guy is ruthless.
Anyhow, good, you got me.
You don't play soccer.
You made a black man blush live. Yeah. I love that. That's good.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tell me from 98 to let's say 2010, okay? You guys have built very young this incredible thing, and now you moving on. The industry of hip-hop, the industry of music is transforming like unbelievable, right? Crazy. How did you find your footage? What was those years in the early 2000s, digital, all that stuff?
Yeah.
How was that?
Yeah, my story. All right, one of the things about me that endears me to people that are interested in me is that I've always been really honest with myself and with what I do. I've never been able to fake it, and it's probably why I'm not very wealthy. Because I have friends that have a much higher tolerance to be around things that make them money but don't mean much to them. And I have no tolerance for that at all. So by 2001, I was on... So in addition to 89.9 WKCR, the station that I was on that had this show that meant so much to so many people and still does, we were also invited to be on Hot 97 starting in 1995. Hot 97 was a new station that entered the marketplace and was going to be kind of the guinea pig of mainstream hip-hop and R&B in a major metropolitan area. And there were people that Hot 97 was developing relationships with, and they were basically saying to Steve, the program director who basically looked like Sammy Hagar, like a California dude with like really tight blonde curls. Like, how is this dude in New York City programming a hip hop station? Yo.
Yeah. Yo. Yo.
Yo.
Yeah,
yeah. And
say no more.
Yeah.
Or do. Or do.
This is the foundation on which Hot 97 was built.
Yeah.
Yo.
Yo. Yeah.
So they were telling him, like, yo, you can't call yourself the home of hip-hop if, like, Stretch and Bob aren't on the radio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we ended up doing a Sunday night show, and it was weird, you know. It was cool to bring our flavor to a big platform like that and
sure.
to play a lot of the music we liked. But it eventually, you know, the culture started changing, the music started changing, Bob and I's taste started really diverging. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we were basically a married couple that started getting sick of each other. And we parted ways when I didn't really even want to go up all the way uptown to do a show from 1 to 5 in the morning. I was DJing in clubs a lot, making more money. Like, Thursday night was like a great night to be out and playing music.
Do your thing.
You know, before the horrible weekend came around, where you really it's harder to make money and play cool music on a Friday and Saturday. So we split ways, and then I was doing Sundays on Hot 97 by myself and just kind of going through the motions for like 3 years. And I mean, I was, keep it real, I was miserable doing that radio show, but I also knew I was on the radio in New York City. Like, you can't just quit that. Like,
at a huge platform.
Yeah, you can't be like a spoiled dude. And I just did it until I think the station, the boss at the station was like, this guy's just not, he's not having fun. Like, let's get someone else in there who's going to be more aligned with what the station's about. Meaning is going to play music on at night, that has more to do with what we're doing in the daytime.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was relieved when I got let go. And for many years after that, I was like on some other shit.
Wow.
Yeah, like. Yeah. Like, because of my reputation, I was still getting flown, like, around the world to DJ. But I would show up and play music that would have the promoters and patrons really scratch their head. Like, yo, what? There was no social media. So it's not like I had this ongoing dialogue with people. It was more like, oh, yo, Stretch is coming. Like, oh, yeah, that dude from the radio. And I would show up and I'd be playing, like, some other shit, and they'd be like, yo, what's going on? And that lasted for like 2 years until like people understood that like I'm not gonna give them what they want. And and then, you know, that led to like, you know, several years of like Stretch in the Wilderness, just like being like, oh, I really fucking shot myself in the foot here. Cause you know, it's easy to like make money and be like, I'm not about the money. And then when the money goes away, you're like, I'm about the money.
Yeah. That's my point.
I need to live. I'm in New York City. That shit is expensive. Like, so, you know, I eventually, changed my attitude and went to work and started, you know, DJing in you know, multiple nights in New York City again. And, but while this was happening, enough time had gone by that like that era that I was so associated with became it was far enough in the past where it meant something else. It wasn't like contemporary culture anymore. It was more like an era in time that had passed that was unique and that was almost like a separate genre from contemporary hip hop. And like as the 2000s progressed, this meant this that dynamic was more and more true, to the point where we end up in like the 2010s where hip hop, like what people know as hip hop, is aesthetically and dogmatically, thematically a totally different thing than the music that the hip hop that we came up with.
Yes.
And that, you know, put me in a funny place, because, you know, when you're young and you're involved in like really progressive, even revolutionary culture, you believe that like change is the thing. Change, you're the underdog. Now fuck all that shit. We're gonna do it this way. And then you find yourself like middle aged or a little bit younger than middle aged, be like, oh no, like the blueprint that we laid down, like that's what young people should be into. And you know, I wrestled with that. And then, you know, then you come out and I'd be like, no, like young people, they have their own thing and they can appreciate this if they want to, but they don't have to. They've got, I mean, like they don't have to, like, who are we to like tell young people that, you know, what
good
they
luck
can
with
and can't do. They
good luck with that. It's going to work out real good.
That's a losing battle. Even care. But you know, the world is a big place, and just as they get to benefit from the internet, like so do we. Like a lot of young people discover, you know, 80s hip hop and 90s hip hop. They discover Stretch and Bobbito, and they fall in love with it. So there's room for everything. And then ultimately, like that period of wilderness, which was followed by like me having to struggle, like to be like this guy that's like, you know, recognized as an influential guy, like some people like, oh, yo, you're a legend, like you're an icon, like whatever. I'm saying that in that voice because I don't really
but it doesn't have to be in that voice also, because it is, you know.
Thank you, you can say it. But to be that guy and to also be like, yo, I gotta hit the pavement and like start to make it happen again. And
I lived in New York during that time, and I remember going to Nell's or going to the Tunnel, going to a place like that. And I know when you and sometimes you're rolling by yourself, or sometimes you're with your friends, or sometimes you're with Bob, or whatever. And like, I was like, there's no way I could even say hi, but I knew you were in the room. It's like, oh, it was a great night. Stretch was in the room. I was like, what did he say? Nothing. Did you talk to him? No, but he was in the room. It's like, I was out. I was good. Yeah. I was like, I'm from Gothenburg, Sweden. I was in the same club as Stretch. You know, it's like, And what did he say? I was like, what do you wear? I was like, oh, he had these fly sneakers on. That's it. Who did he talk to? I don't know. But that was enough for me to be out. I was like, oh, my night was done. So, yeah, thank you. That's how nerdy I was. So,
anyway. And then ultimately, like, Bob and I, we made our film.
Yes.
And that led to he and I being invited to do a podcast for NPR for
Amazing.
Two seasons. And our guests were Dave Chappelle, Rakim, Black Thought, Beastie Boys, Mahershala yes. Ali, Rosie yes. Perez, Stevie Wonder, Lenny Kravitz. I mean, we really...
Yes,
Regina King. We killed that podcast. It was a part of this this push by NPR to develop a more diverse audience in terms of race, in terms of age, because mm. like the average NPR listener is like a 47-year-old white guy, and
or a black man. Those interviews are incredible, by the way. Incredible.
Yeah, no.
Was it only interview based, or was it also playing?
No,
music?
It was interview based. And then at the end of the show, he and I would each play a song for our guests, and we talk about what the song meant. Mm. We toured the world, showing our film, doing Q&As, and really like you know sparked. The interest of a new generation in what we did, of course, Amazing. You know, culture always reverberates like that. Like you know, everyone's into the '90s now, so we're a part of that kind of reexamination, and it's crazy that you know we celebrated our 31st anniversary of our first show last week, and like Bob and I, like we still do a lot of stuff together, and it's.
So
it's incredible.
Are you working on a show together today?
We have a show on Apple Music called Stretch and Bobbito Radio every other week. Yeah.
Yeah,
people are so, you know, you can listen to Apple Music live for free. No one knows that. And you can also subscribe to Apple Music and listen to the archive. Clark Kent's on, DJ Spinna's on.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I didn't know that.
And for the price of a K9 Posse cassette,
you can
subscribe for 1 month and then see if you like it or not.
I was actually I was actually with Vin from Noted by Nature last night. I told him I was hanging with you if we see you today. And he's like, we just turned 30 this year, but we couldn't celebrate it because
it
was
exactly.
like...
exactly. Same thing. Yeah.
And I said, I might run into Stretch tomorrow. And he's like, oh, say what's up.
Oh,
you
know? Cool.
And
Vin
looks
cool,
good.
Cool,
he's
cool.
good.
But are you still, like, in 2021, do you still DJ at clubs? Or is that...
Well, not now. No. But I didn't...
I mean, other than the pandemic.
But yeah, no,
the
I still...
thing of the pandemic.
I love DJing.
Yeah.
I love it. When everything is right at a gig, it's like, I'm just the happiest dude. I have a friend Heidi who has this Instagram account called Friends from New York, and she threw a party in LA with, and I think a lot of the people that showed up were people that were from New York that live in LA. They've got to stick together because LA is a horrible place, and people from LA are horrible. So if they're other New Yorkers, you got
to
hang out.
Yeah, you have to get them together.
And then she did one. At the Roof Lounge at the Graduate Hotel on Roosevelt Island, and like 500 people showed up in masks. Yeah. And she said, hey, you want to do a Friends from New York party outdoors at the South Street Seaport on the pier?
Sick.
I said, of course I do. And that was, was it last weekend? It was last weekend.
Yeah. Mm.
And so... early in the night, like Ellie Escobar, another incredible DJ, he's playing before me. This guy comes up to me. He's like, yo, Stretch, I haven't seen you DJ since Mars. Yo, Mars closed in 1991.
Yeah.
I was like, old school. What are you doing?
Old school.
The crowd that showed up was like, I mean, it was incredible. It was, there were so many people that I haven't seen, not because of COVID, just because we stopped going to clubs every night. And, 500 people showed up, and I literally was transported back to, like, my 25-year-old self, where, like, multiple times a week, I felt like I was at the center of the universe playing the best new music for, like, the coolest people in the coolest city. And it was... incredible. This was just last week. Literally one of the best DJ experiences that I've had in 10 years. And I'm sure coming out of COVID, had a lot to do with that as well.
So keeping about talking about evolving, two things. We want to claim you as Swedes. We stretch this. So now you're also a Swede, right? Tell us about the Swedish connection, and tell us about your daughter, how that changed your life.
Well, so I don't want to give a lot of attention to this, but I, in 1995, I dated a Swedish girl in New York. Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah.
You're not unique by that, actually. I would like to say that's unique, but it's actually okay.
If you thought it was interesting, her father was Ethiopian and her mother was Swedish, and you know, that was a short lived thing. And then in the 2000s, a really dear friend of mine to this day, Alex Strell, mm-hmm. who lived, he was like a hip hop industry operator in the 90s. Mm-hmm. He moved back to Sweden, and he flew me to Stockholm to DJ a party. And, you know, he was promoting it, so he invited his friends down. And he introduced me to a lovely young woman named Monica. And I was like, wow, this girl's beautiful. And Monica eventually moved to New York, and I remember being at David Perez's house and studio, aka Shady. He's a photographer, a video director, and just like one of these like New York characters who knows everybody. And if you don't know him, you should know him. And he had a bunch of photos on his wall of, like, you know, models and things he was working on. And I discreetly took a photograph of the wall because there was a picture of Monica on it and I wanted a picture of her. Yeah. But I was acting like, oh, this is Shady. I really like your work. Let me and so Monica moved to New York and I would bump into her like every year. Mm-hmm. But I always had a girlfriend. She always had a boyfriend. And also I'd also be really nervous every time I'd see her. Yeah. I remember once I ended up at what's called Lifetime, the health food store on 6th Avenue between, what is it, 8th and 9th Street or 9th? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're in the produce section, like, for, like, feeling fruits and vegetables, and Monica's right there. I'm, like, squeezing a melon, like, staring at her, like, I don't know what to say. Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, now she'd be like, oh, my God, you were so weird.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You barely talked to me. Yeah, I was like, I didn't know what to say. And then, you know, through we're talking about the bad things about the internet. The good thing is I was able to reach out to her via Instagram, and I knew she was single. I was single, and we ended up at Coachella.
Amazing.
And hung out that weekend, and she was surprised that I actually could speak.
Yeah, you weren't squeezing any fruit.
And she liked what I had to say. And literally, like, I went back to California another time, and then you know, like my dad importing my mom from Poland, I imported her from Los Angeles. We've been together ever since, and we welcomed our baby girl, Naima.
Congratulations.
In April, our Venezuelan, Swedish, Polish, Jewish, New Yorker.
I love it.
Yeah.
Man.
Yes.
Congrats.
Yeah. That's an amazing story. So, Jason, we have to, and this is a time where you guys are Swedish but living in New York, so pick the New York side. Now is the time to ask Stretch, Jason, and myself any question. We're here for it. Anything about anything you have
anything
to say.
Anything about anything.
Anything
yeah.
about you, exactly. Yeah. But before we go there, I just want to say thank you so much. You've been a major force in both of our lives for a long time. And the journey about passion, the journey about making choices, alternative, the choices that you made put you in this position where you are today. And your journey is so inspirational. And we really appreciate you. And thank you for everything you've done for the
thank
culture
you.
Yeah. and the people
Thanks for
you
coming
inspired
on
the throughout
well, it,
the world.
It means a lot coming from you guys.
Thank you.
You know, even before we met, of course, you're
at the ping pong table. That's it.
Listen, I really was,
table.
You know, I mean, jokes aside, like my grandfather took me to Aquavit.
Oh wow.
So long ago. So I knew your story 15 years plus before I saw you slicing and spinning those ping pong balls on the other side of the table.
Anyhow, so yes, Bjorn, we're going to put you in the position to ask the first question because you don't have a choice. You're part of the fam.
There we go.
So, if you're not part of the fam, you can wait a little bit. But Bjorn has no choices. Yeah, no options.
So,
hello.
All right. Thanks, man. Well,
Jason knows I have to ask this question, but what's your problem with LA?
LA.
Don't get us started.
I love going to LA because I have so many friends that live there. So it's just to me, it's a massive suburb, and who wants to live in the suburbs? I mean, New York. I could walk from Soho to Red Rooster and be like,
seen the world,
bump into friends, and see stuff I never saw before, and.
But I think that thing is real for us New Yorkers, right? Like, I was just with a chef friend a couple of days ago, and she's like, I'm going to L.A., and I feel so weird about it because it's awkward, because in New York, we're so socially connected, right? And we really had to put a plan. I said, call this person. She knows the best hikes. Call this chef. He does pizzas in his backyard. I had to break down a list of, and they were all New Yorkers actually living in LA.
I don't hate LA, and LA people are not as horrible as
he's just saying that because he lives there.
I just would not want to live there for more than 7 days. But I have a lot of friends in LA that I love. Some of whom actually are from LA. Yeah, it's true. I'll admit it.
He's a liar. We're friends. I'm from LA.
Do you hike when you're there?
I have hiked.
It's a very LA thing to do. In Sweden, we just call it a tom promenade, which is basically just walking.
Right. You know?
But a hike sounds like it. I'm always amazed by Americans say, we're going to go on a hike. Yeah. It feels like we're going to go mountain climbing. But you really mean we're just taking a walk.
Yeah, I know. Mountain climbing, relax.
But they love to do that in
that's
LA.
That's not a mountain. Yeah. Climbed a mountain. That's a hill.
It's an incline.
All right. Thank you all. This is a great start for the weekend. So great way to spend a Friday afternoon or evening. So one question to you guys. But first you, is there... by the way, and I'm Norwegian, I'm not Swedish, so I hope you don't hold that against
that's
me.
All right. Yeah, that's all right. All right.
Yeah. Oh, snap.
Whoa. Hey.
You know what? I don't have a question.
No. He's just in ping pong mode, that's all. You know.
Exactly. Has there ever been an artist that you guys, or a rapper or whoever, that you thought was going to be big but didn't? Like,
that's a good question.
Yeah, I mean there are plenty, and yeah, no, really, we you know, our show was people asked, how did people get up there? It was kind of either people came up there through a trusted source, or we like to say it was like, you know, when you're making documentaries, you like to use these like fancy words, like, oh, it's a meritocracy. but it kind of was. I mean, we wanted it to be. We wanted sort of to highlight like the best of the best. And, you know, sometimes some weeks were better than others. Some artists had better performances, the first time, maybe the second time wasn't there. I mean, I think one artist who I think not only did we feel that, like, just based on who he was as a person and what he did on our station, but also his actual body of work should have been much more commercially successful, is OC, who's just like a brilliant, he's like really a craftsman when it comes to lyricism, and he spent so much time working on what he did, and the efficiency of language. Like, there's nothing in his lyrics that's just filler. It's like everything has a meaning, everything has a purpose, and he picked really great beats and had great concepts, and just one of those artists who, I think you know, why did someone like Nas pop off, but he didn't? You know, I don't know. I mean, there's so many variables that go into the success of a recording artist. You know, it's like there's so many things that can go wrong, and when they all go right, it's kind of like a mini miracle. You know, he's part of a crew called DITC, which is Digging in the Crates, which you know, that's like Diamond D, Fat Joe, Buck Wild. It's like Lord Finesse.
Big L.
A lot of Fat Joe is the only dude from that camp that really, you know, became a legit pop star, and he'll still do stuff with them. Buck Wild, as a producer, you know, he's done some really big records, and Lord Finesse has like ghost produced, like done stuff with Dr. Dre. But check out OC. I mean, like the albums that he had on Wild Pitch are the ones I'm most familiar with. I mean, he's still recording. But I'm not immersed in underground hip hop anymore. Like, I don't know what he's done after 2001. But his album Jewels, and there's another one. I mean, like they're
Word
great.
Life.
Word Life. Thank you. Yeah. Word Life and Jewels are like incredible hip hop albums.
But a beautiful part of hip hop in the 90s was that, like, success to us, the listeners and fans, was not measured in like commercial success. So really wasn't like, it was almost adverse to how it is today, that somebody was rich or was on the top of the Billboard charts was not what was like the underground and like whatever artists we were hearing. I mean, I guess your radio show being the exception, because you had artists that went on to, like Jay-Z, for example, went on to still to this day be the most recognizable rapper on the, you know,
but it wasn't the
Earth,
premise of the show at all.
But like opposite. Underground was way just like more interesting than
sure.
I guess in the 90s too, the people who were commercially successful, oftentimes the quality was watered down and not really as interesting as what, say, Mobb Deep was doing, or, you know, or OC for that matter.
Sure. It's just, you know, when someone isn't popping enough to maintain their career, to maintain their ego, to and I'm not suggesting that that's what was happening with OC. I just, in general, like that struggle was really real, and like, you know, how do you find that balance between being able to make enough money to feel like you're bettering your place, true, but also not compromising what you do to make that money. And and that's a common story, probably all the time. That doesn't end.
Mm. Mona.
So I would like to hear from the three of you your connection to the next generation. And
well, for me, it's around sustainability. You know, I think as a chef with a platform, I think about the food and the movement. So how can I bring people together? Red Rooster is very much about how can you define sort of race and culture and bring people together, right? And our next project in Chelsea will be about sustainability and contributing in a better way, right? Opening doors to new ways of how people can come to a restaurant and finding the intersection between delicious and sustainable. So for me, it's all about inclusion and sustainability and affordability through the food lens.
I think for me in Sweden, it's basically just kind of showing, specifically, I think, young artists today who are open, who contact me and want to talk. I still feel kind of responsible for hip-hop culture in Sweden, and like I want it to,
I want
it to do well. You know, we had a bad week last week, you know, one of Sweden's, but heard of it, yeah. And this young man, Einar, this kid, you know, 19-year-old, was shot and killed, and so a lot of, like, especially this week, there's been a lot of conversation, this week following that, a lot of conversation around, you know, hip-hop culture and what it means, and, you know, where some people have been like, well, you know, like, and that's nothing new, you know, trying to place the blame on hip-hop or on hip-hop music even, which is really ridiculous, but that is also nothing new. You know, we saw that in the 90s several times, and, you know, here it is again. So it's a very kind of, but it's also a difficult discussion when you're talking to somebody who's 25 years younger than you and is just at the outset. Like, it is also your right to make your own mistakes, and I don't know what your landscape looks like today, or what it means to be 19, 20, 21 today, or why it's important for you to talk about these things. I mean, hip-hop culture has always been a mirror where artists kind of talk about the environment that they find themselves in. That doesn't mean that they're the reason for the environment being that way. Quite the contrary, I would say, you know.
Bob and I, separately and together, have always made ourselves available to younger people anytime they invite us to speak or do whatever. I mean, whether it's the Lower East Side Girls Club, where we've spoken, and or you know, doing workshops at other schools on podcasting or whatever. It's not, doesn't really take up a lot of my time, and it's more of a passive thing. But I'm always available to young people that maybe the older person that's running the show might be interested or think that it's a good idea to bring us in. But I'm always delighted when young people are into what we did. I know when I was that age, we benefited from being into hip-hop at a time when hip-hop owed so much to what happened 20, 30, 40 years before it, right? Because all the inspiration, all the samples, all the music was old music. So there was this kind of DNA that was an essential component to hip-hop, which a lot of people have lost, because most hip-hop now is not made with sampling old records. A lot of it is, but that's not what the average kid in the world is going to think hip-hop is. So to be able to even talk about that and tell that story, I think is worthwhile, because that is just one aspect of what made hip-hop such a revolutionary and enthralling and magnetic music and culture.
Well, Stretch, I just want to say we salute you. Thank you is not enough. We salute you for being the pioneer that you still are.
I don't have been 31 years and counting. I don't like to be called a pioneer.
Oh no, but
because
a super spreader.
Actual pioneers do not get enough of the credit and acknowledgement that they deserve.
But it took that passion of several generations to really build hip hop to what it was, and you were really active in that golden era.
Yeah.
And that's what really pushed hip hop outside of just New York City and the United States or the tri-state area to Romania, Poland, even Sweden and China and Ethiopia and all these places. So in that sense, seen from a Swedish perspective.
Thank you. But, I keep interrupting you every time.
We salute you, man.
Every time you give me my accolades, I interrupt you.
And thank you for coming on this moment.
Absolutely.
DJ Stretch Armstrong.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.